Before we start our episode today, I want to talk a little bit about a hard topic, fertility. If you are one of the many women struggling to become pregnant again, just know that we're thinking of you and sending you the most positive thoughts. For mamas trying to conceive or struggling with fertility, I encourage you to check out Needed. When the two founders of Needed began their fertility journey, they were shocked to see the lack of nutrition advice provided. Along with creating an amazing line of prenatal vitamins, omega-3s, and other essentials, they offer egg quality support for women and sperm plus for men. These are things that are not often talked about. I wanted to share more about both of those products. Needed's egg quality support is designed to support egg cell health as they develop into mature eggs. Improving egg quality can support fertility outcomes. It's never too early or too late to start focusing on egg quality, but for optimal results, they recommend taking egg support at least 3 months before trying to conceive or freezing the eggs. For Needed Sperm Support Plus, it combines targeted and clinically studied ingredients, pre and probiotics, antioxidants, and botanicals for the whole body approach to male fertility. Expertly formulated for men who are thinking of trying to conceive and for men's vitality at stages of all life. If you are pregnant or trying to conceive, or even in your postpartum stages, consider switching to Needed to get 20% off your order by using code VBAC20. That is thisisneeded.com and use code VBAC20 at checkout. Hello, women of strength. It's Megan, and I am so excited to be joining you today with our friend, Nicole Calloway Rankins. Dr. Nicole Calloway Rankins is incredible. We've been following her for a long time and have collaborated with her in the past and are so excited to be having her on the podcast today. Dr. Rankins is a board certified practicing OBGYN, wife, mom, and podcast host here to help you get calm, confident, and empower you to have a beautiful birth you deserve. She was born into a family of educators that she felt a pull to medical school the day she looked in the mirror and saw a vision of herself in a white coat. And get this, it all happened while she was studying to be an engineer. She says, "I know that sounds crazy, but that vision has led me to exactly where I am supposed to be today. Serving pregnant women, she's delivered more than 1,000 babies and have demystified childbirth for thousands more through her 5-star rated All About Pregnancy and Birth podcast," which she's going to be talking about a little bit more today. I'm so excited for her. She says over 2 million downloads and her online birth plan and childbirth education classes. You guys, she is really changing so much about the birth world. She's incredible. You're going to hear it today. I love chatting with her. You can find her at drnicolerankins.com. And of course, we'll have all of her other podcasts and Instagram and all of that in the show notes. So get ready. We're excited. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about common questions from an OBGYN, but then we're also going to be diving into questions from you guys, from you personally. I reached out on Instagram and said, "Hey, what are your questions for this doctor?" She is so excited to answer them. And she did. We went through every single question that was asked on our Instagram community. So I'm so excited. I'm going to get to the intro and then we are going to start with Dr. Rankins. Hi. My name is Megan. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast. I am a VBAC after 2 C-section mama, a wife, doula, and VBAC educator. This podcast was created to hold space for those wanting to know their options for birth after cesarean. It is a space where you will likely find yourself getting better educated, relate to stories like your own, and finding the inspiration to help you have a better birth experience. Although we will be sharing stories related to cesarean and VBAC, this podcast is for anyone and everyone who wants to receive evidence-based information and learn how to avoid unnecessary or undesired cesareans. The purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. It is not meant to replace advice from any other medical professional. You guys, Dr. Rankins is back with us today, and I'm so excited. Funny enough, I keep saying like you're back, but you actually did... You've never done the podcast with us.
I don't think so. We did a class.
Mm-hmm. We did a class, which was phenomenal. And everyone ranted and raved about it. So we have you back together. We're back together, but we have you for the first time on the podcast. So welcome.
Yes. Well, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
We just adore you. And I love getting your opinion on things. I think, you know, from doulas, from midwives to, to OBs, we all have different opinions and experiences. And if there's anyone that has like hands-on experience, it is you and a midwife, right? Like someone who is physically handling.
I've done this a couple thousand times. So.
Yes, versus my like 300 and something births.
No, so don't discount it. That's very excellent.
It's still super great, but when it comes to thousands and an understanding on an even deeper level, it's just always so fun and it's very compliment. It's a compliment to the podcast to have your expertise.
Yeah, I've been at this 23 years, so it's a long time.
Yes, and still going, and still going.
Still going, yes.
And, okay, tell me, we can edit this if you want, but you have a new podcast coming out.
I do.
Now, it's not going to be, by the time this airs, it's not going to be out just yet, but can you tell us a little bit more about it and where people can find it?
Yeah, so it's still going to be in the same feed. So if you subscribe to the old podcast, it's just going to change, you know, keep the same feed, but it's going to have a new name and a, like a bit of a new focus, still related to pregnancy and birth, but it's just a bit tighter. I want to say the name so bad, but I'm not going to.
Okay. Don't let it out. We will find out when it is released.
Yes.
But tell them where to go follow right now.
If you follow me on Instagram, even though I'm, you know, taking a little break now, you'll get it there. But the podcast is called All About Pregnancy and Birth. Go ahead and subscribe and you can be the first one to know when the first episodes come out. I just have a new lots of new ways to present information about pregnancy and birth and frameworks and things. Like, okay, I'll give a little hint. Like one of the first things I'm talking about is one thing that's so important to pregnancy and your birth experience is your mindset. So one of the things I created is this MAMA mindset framework, and MAMA stands for meditation, affirmations, move your body, attitude of gratitude. So I have practices, exercises, things we're going to talk about. And that's just one little tiny sliver of the things that I've been working on and writing. And so just good, great stuff.
Yay. Oh my gosh. So excited. And that is even more applied with just birth in general, but VBAC, I feel like mindset, attitude, all these things that you were just saying, like so important because we, even though we're just moms going and having babies, we have some extra things that some extra barriers that sometimes we have to either break through or we run into.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a calm mind creates a confident birth. So when you have that calm mind, that is like the first step to helping you create a confident birth experience. So mindset is really important.
Yeah, it really is. Well, I'm excited to chat with you today and I'm excited to listen to that sometime here in the near future, and listen to more of what you are bringing to the table. Okay, so one of the questions that I would like to go over is the word allow. What does the word allow mean? How does someone navigate something that maybe doesn't feel right for them, but they're being told, and on both sides, right? So Dr. Fox and I have talked about, like, sometimes it's not right for the provider. Like, you're not the right patient for that provider because what you want is not comfortable with the provider, and vice versa. So, but we often hear, or actually more see it on like the VBAC Link community and Facebook and our comments of, my doctor said they will allow, or my midwife said they'll allow me to if... So what, when you are saying that, or maybe have you said that, what does that mean? And how does
I don't say that word. So,
okay.
it's a word that should not be in the discussion about birth, because allow implies like a hierarchical relationship where I get to make the decisions about what does or does not happen in someone's pregnancy, birth, labor, body. And that is not true. You as the person giving birth are the one who ultimately makes the decisions, not your doctor or not your midwife. We can't really allow anything. We're not your parents, you know what I mean? So allow shouldn't be part of the conversation. It's a leftover term from just a general patriarchal foundation of OBGYN, particularly when men took over into the specialty and, you know, kind of banished midwives. is how that language came about, is we need to tell folks and we need to control. So it really shouldn't be the case, but it still kind of hangs around. Words matter and it's important. So even though people don't necessarily mean it with any sort of ill intent, or that they mean it, that they're trying to control you, it inherently sort of subconsciously implies that. So I strongly dislike the word allow.
Allow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am with you too. As someone who has had that word happen to me, it made me feel like, I don't know, like I had to do something to meet their standard quota to get that allowance.
Right.
You know, and that just didn't feel great. It felt
icky. Yeah.
So if someone is saying that, are there any tips of advice that you would give?
Yeah, I mean, first off, if you hear it, I mean, that's maybe a little notch of a red flag potentially, that it's not going to be a shared decision-making process, because really it should be about, like, my role is to give you information and share my expertise with you to help you come up with the best decision for yourself. And that looks like various things for different people. Some people want tons of information. They want to think about it and then, you know, talk about it. Mm-hmm. Some people are like, just tell me what to do, which, right? You know, if that's what you want me to do, then I can do that too. So if you hear allow, then it's concerning that there may not be that shared decision making. So that's a little bit of a red flag to know. But then sort of open it up for discussion. So it kind of depends on what the situation is. So is it like, right, we don't allow you to eat or drink during labor, or we don't allow TOLAC? Then the next question is really why? Mm-hmm. So why, especially for something that's important for you. So why, and you, if you want to use the language back, you can even use it back, but why is that not allowed? Why is that the case? And then kind of take the discussion from there.
Yeah. I think asking the question just in general, why, or, okay, I hear you, can you explain to me?
Yes.
Really helps there be a discussion, like you were saying. And I feel like when it comes to birth, like you're saying, you're like, I'm not your parent, but like, it needs to be a collaborative effort here. Mm-hmm. Like we're trusting you to help us with this really amazing event in our life. But at the same time, we have to have equal trust from you. Right. And it's this collaboration of like, let's talk about what we want this to look like.
Yeah, it's definitely trust and collaboration are key in order to have a great birth experience. And ideally, you want to try to work on that foundation during your prenatal appointments, so that by the time you get to the hospital, you know that you're going to have that relationship. Actually, regardless of what doctors there or nurses say, you create this environment of trust and collaboration. So when you ask the question why, don't necessarily start off, and this is part of like the psychology of human behavior, you don't necessarily have to start off with, well, why? Like,
well,
why?
Yeah, attitude.
Yeah. Yes, because advocacy is not about creating conflict, creating chaos. Advocacy is really about creating that collaboration and creating that trust. It's the end result. So start from a place of trying to connect, ask, learn information, and then kind of go from there.
Yeah, love that. Well, thank you. Okay, fetal monitoring. And I know this is actually going to be a question down the line, or maybe it's a little different, but fetal monitoring with VBAC in hospitals, it's typically required. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the evidence on that, of like why? Again, here's the question, why is that done, and dive in deeper? And we talk about that in our course, but I think it's so great to talk directly to an OBGYN of like more to understand your point of view.
Yeah, the reason that's the case is that one of the first signs of uterine rupture is going to be a change in the fetal heart rate. So that's why we always want to see the fetal heart rate, because it's going to be the first indication that there's potentially an issue. So it's really that simple. Even potentially before you start having pain, some people may or may not have bleeding, but it's going to be fetal heart rate changes and pain are going to be the things that will clue us in. And we don't want to miss that if it happens.
So what, when a fetal heart changes, we know through labor, this is a spinoff of the question, we know babies' heart rates fluctuate up and down. Sometimes they might have like a compression in the cord that causes the heart rate to go really down during the uterine contraction, and then it goes up, but it goes really down. It's like, ooh, that's low. And then it goes right back up to its baseline. So what is a concerning fetal trace in this scenario?
Right. Yeah. So this is the part where I have to say, like, this is the reason we do 4 years of OBGYN residency, why we have to take fetal heart rate monitoring training every couple of years to stay up on it. This isn't something that can be had in a subtle conversation, because it's not just what you see in the moment. It's what you see in the moment. And then you try to, and the things we look for in general are a baseline of the heart rate between 110 and 150, 160, roughly. We look for things called accelerations, decelerations, and the variability, which is like the squiggliness of it. That's like the big picture. But when we look at it, it's like, okay, we assess it. And then we try to do some things to improve the heart rate. We look at how the heart rate looks over time. Has it gotten worse over time? If we do some things to get it better, then that's considered good. So we can't really say, like, if you see this specific snapshot of a fetal heart rate, then that's going to be the thing that triggers things. It really just depends.
Makes total sense.
And it can also be contractions, because it's like, sometimes if you're having too many contractions back to back, and like there's no time to get a break. So like the baby's like, can I just have a minute to breathe in between these contractions, please? Yeah. So maybe we need to slow down the contractions. So we really, it's a lot of things that go into it. And that's where our expertise comes in.
Yeah. It's a big math equation in a lot of ways when it comes to tracings and things like that. Okay. So then
when I do want to say, like, so a lot of times people think monitoring equals no movement. But more and more hospitals these days have wireless monitoring, so you're able to move. That's definitely a question you want to ask ahead of time, if wireless monitoring options are available, so that you're able to move around.
Yeah. Yeah, because they've got, at least, I don't know if it's what it's called here, but we call it like the Monica. It's just like that little like sandpaper on your belly, and that's kind of nice. Sandpaper sounds harsh. It's light. It's a light little scrub. So it gets the oils off your skin. But so that's a really nice thing. Awesome. Okay. And then scar thickness. This is a really big one. And we've talked a little bit about it with Dr. Fox in the past, but scar thickness and double versus single stitch closure is a very, very common question that we are getting. Wondering of the evidence that you know to show that someone maybe shouldn't TOLAC, or the evidence on thinner scars, because it seems like it's becoming a new standard. It kind of is like coming in with the VBAC calculator is what we're seeing. It's like we're doing the VBAC calculator and we're measuring the scar, and those kind of two things are kind of like becoming routine. And then of course, once we review op reports, double versus single.
Yeah. So the double versus single doesn't make a difference. So whether you had a double layer closure or a single layer closure, you're still a candidate for a VBAC. So that one is pretty easy. I don't even look at op notes for double versus single layer. It really just needs to be a low transverse incision on the uterus, on the low part of the uterus. So that's that. Mm-hmm. As far as the scar thickness, the rationale behind that is that when the uterus ruptures, it literally just thins out until it ruptures open generally. So when we're measuring that scar thickness, the physiology of it makes sense that if it's really thin and then you start to put the pressure of contractions on it, there may be a higher chance of it rupturing. Now, is there hard data that if it's this amount that is definitely going to rupture, or you should or shouldn't TOLAC? Not necessarily. In our area, it's not routinely measured or talked about. It's not anything that we discuss. So it's not a routine part of practice, but that's the thought behind it. And typically it may come up if it's noticed, like if it's very noticeable, like if the ultrasound, the maternal fetal medicine specialist or whoever does the ultrasound says, this uterine scar, like where it is really, really thin. And then it may come up. But in general, I don't see that come up very often.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good to know.
Yeah.
It just seems, like, oh my goodness. Are you hearing that ding?
I don't hear
it. Okay, good. I hope you're not hearing it on my end. Yeah. My computer keeps dinging and then, but it's on mute. So I'm not really sure what's going on. I'm having all the technical issues today. anyway, that's really, really good to know though, because it is something that so many people are hyper-focusing on. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think there's other things to hyper-focus on, like our nutrition and finding that supportive provider and getting the education and really understanding the choice that we're making when we VBAC.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not focusing on it, so I don't think you should focus on it.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes, but it is. I think it is probably hard for these people when they go to these visits. They're so excited they want to have a TOLAC or a VBAC, and then they're like, "Oh, well, we have to do these things first to see if you qualify." And it's like, "Oh." Right.
And scar thickness is just not. It's not part of ACOG recommendation. It's not part of what determines whether or not you can have VBAC. So
I know it shouldn't be anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
But for some reason we're still kind of seeing it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good to know that you guys, if you're having that be said, maybe just think twice about,
or get a second opinion.
Or I was going to say get a second opinion. Yep. Yeah. Okay. So our community asked questions. I went on and said that we were going to have you on and they were so excited and kind of just like let all the questions go.
Sure.
So one of the questions was, if you don't get an epidural for a VBAC and you need a C-section, will you have to be put fully out? So under general anesthesia?
Yeah, no, not necessarily. And most likely not. Generally, as long as it's not an emergency, there's time to do a spinal. The difference between epidural and spinal, epidural is a catheter that stays in place and medicine continually gets fed through the catheter, where spinal is a one-shot dose of medicine that lasts for 2 to 3 hours. So as long as there's time and you can sit up for the spinal, or they can lay you on your side for the spinal, then they can do the spinal for the C-section and you don't have to do general. General anesthesia is only reserved for if it's truly an emergency and there's not enough time to do the spinal.
Right. And for this is another, I'm adding this, but epidural versus spinal, longevity of effectiveness, meaning like you're numb enough for them to perform
the surgery. Yeah, the spinal is going to wear off.
Quickly, but it's going to go on quicker, right? Deeper.
It's a denser numbing than what you get with an epidural. When you get an epidural before, if you have an epidural and then you go to a C-section, then you just get a bigger dose of medicine that kind of mimics what you get through the spinal. So the thing about the spinal is that it's meant to cover a surgery. So it's going to be a larger dose of medicine. So you're going to be more numb because we don't actually want you to be completely numb during labor. So the spinal is really just to make sure you're nice and as numb and don't feel the surgery.
And how long does it take to kick in to be numb enough? Like 20 minutes?
Yeah, I would say 30. Between when it's actually pretty quickly. So yes, you're right. It can kick in a little bit faster than epidural because it's a lot more medicine. So typically I would say within 5 to 10 minutes, you're going to start feeling numbness pretty quickly. But by the time we've like laid you down, washed your belly, put in the catheter, done those things, then you're numb.
Yeah. So in that non-emergency situation, you're going to have plenty of time to be numb and not have to be put under general anesthesia.
Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm.
In an emergent situation, we have minutes, right? We have minutes to work with. How many minutes, right? Like, would you say we have, if we're having fetal distress, and obviously it could vary for a lot of patients, I'm sure, but major fetal distress, emergent, like true emergent under general anesthesia, like what are we looking at time frame before we get baby out, before we're really concerned?
Yeah, I mean, so if it's true like an emergency, because a lot of people say they had an emergency C-section, it's actually not emergency.
Baby was born 2 hours later.
Yeah, or even 30 minutes later. Yeah. So emergency is going to be like, we're ripping the cords out of the wall. We're running down the hall to the operating room. When we get in the operating room, the heart rate is still in the 60s. So we want baby out in like 5 minutes. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's like, we want baby out as quickly as possible. Right. And the quickest way to get a baby out is general anesthesia and then go if you don't already have a spinal.
Right. Mm-hmm. Perfect. That's also another common question of like, well, how long do I have if I don't have that because that's a big deciding factor for people, like not wanting to go unmedicated or wanting to go unmedicated, but not wanting to be in an emergent situation. And those emergent situations, they happen. We can't sugarcoat it. They happen. But they are more rare. And I love that you pointed that out. Like a lot of people say this was an emergent situation and we hear, well, then they went out and they came back in and 25, 30 minutes plus later, they had a baby.
That's not an emergent. As a matter of fact, emergency C-sections are fairly rare. Knock on wood. I can't remember the last time I've had to run somebody down the hall for a C-section. Yeah. So,
and I call those crash, like crash sections. Everybody crashes and goes.
Things are moving so quickly. So
We're going to take a quick break to continue talking about fertility. I know many of our beautiful women of strength listening join us right after their cesarean birth. And when you're in your postpartum stages, many of your nutrition needs actually increase. And if you're thinking about having another baby, I invite you to take a moment to educate yourself on the support that our favorite prenatal supplement Needed offers for both fertility and postpartum. When the two founders of Needed began their fertility journey, they were shocked to see the lack of nutrition advice provided. Along with creating an amazing line of prenatal vitamins, omega-3s, and other essentials, they offer eggs quality support for women and sperm support for men. Again, this is not something we often talk about. Male fertility impacts conception and a healthy pregnancy, and it is in decline due to stress, toxins, aging, and other lifestyle factors. Hormone and gut health of your partner directly influences sperm quantity and quality, and ultimately the DNA passed from sperm to baby. I love that Needed not only thinks about the female fertility, but also about the male fertility. Needed does an amazing job thinking about and supporting us women through the fertility journey. They offer prenatals, omega-3s, antioxidant-rich and egg quality support supplements, and it is formulated by prenatal health practitioners to help you and your eggs thrive. You are born with all of your egg cells, or oocytes. And the oocyte takes 3 to 4 months to mature before ovulation. Needed egg quality support is designed to support egg cell health as they develop into mature eggs. Improving egg quality can support fertility outcomes, and it's never too early or too late to focus on egg quality. So we hope you can check out thisisneeded.com and enjoy 20% off with code VBAC20. Again, that is VBAC20 at thisisneeded.com. Back to today's show. Let's take a moment to talk about Coterie wipes, because they're just as amazing as their diapers. These wipes are made from 100% plant-based fibers and are up to 30% larger than most other brands, making them perfect for even the messiest of situations. They're also hypoallergenic and dermatologist tested, so they're safe for newborns and even eczema-prone skin. One of our team members shared that these wipes have been a game changer, gentle enough for delicate skin, but durable enough to get the job done with fewer wipes. They've even earned the National Eczema Association's Seal of Acceptance. You guys, you can pair these with Coterie diapers for a high-performance diaper duo. And do not forget, you can get 20% off with code VBAC20 of your first order of $40 or more. Add a pack of these incredible wipes to your order to see the difference.
Okay, so someone says, do I need an OB for a VBAC? I have lost all trust in nurses and doctors after being forced into a C-section, which breaks my heart that this question is a thing. I see it all the time. People have been, you know, quote unquote, wronged or bullied.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that way. Sometimes it happens.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like... Mm-hmm. Do you have to have an OB? Obviously, we know the answer is no.
No, you can have a midwife for sure.
You can have a midwife, but maybe I want to like spin it to like more of a positive. Like if we have an OB, how can we better establish a relationship with them so we're not in a situation in the end feeling pressured or bullied?
Yeah. And actually, I want you to even back it up even further. And this is for anybody having a baby. What you want, you don't specifically want a midwife, you don't specifically want an OB. What you want is someone who's going to listen to you, respect your wishes, and really center you in your birth experience. So yes, midwives are great at that, but sometimes midwives can be tricky too. And the way that the reason I said mm-hmm. that is because I know people who were like, Mike, I had a midwife and I thought it was going to be great and it wasn't. And they were hanging too much weight on that midwife hat.
Midwife word.
Yes. So you really need to start with, is this person listening to me and respecting me? So whether that's midwife or OB. Okay.
Yeah.
So take that away first. And then if you have an OB again, because the midwife is also going to work with an OB, and I'm assuming you're doing in the hospital, you want someone who is not just like, you know, like, oh, if you go into labor, you can have a VBAC. I mean, I guess that's okay. Or you want somebody who's really actually supportive of it. And I think you've used this language before, not just tolerant of a VBAC, that they actually support you and don't just tolerate the possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have kind of been thinking about that. Like, you know, we as doulas, it's like, oh, I want someone to advocate for me. And that big word advocate. Mm-hmm. And then what does that look like? But in a lot of ways, I think that's how I want a supportive provider to do, is advocate for me. Like, I understand, mm-hmm. validate me. I understand mm-hmm. this is what you want. And we're going to do everything we can in our power to do this. If there's something along the way that is saying maybe we shouldn't, I will have that discussion with you. I will not just tell you what you have to do. Exactly. Again, it goes back to that conversation we were having in the beginning of that collaborative relationship, right? Mm-hmm. If that is there, I think you set yourself up for better expectation, no matter who it is, with an OB or a midwife.
Definitely.
Yeah. And nurses can be tricky. We love our nurses. They're incredible.
Yeah.
But sometimes they have opinions, and sometimes they come in and they put it on us.
And here's the thing that people don't realize. You can ask for a new nurse.
You can. Yes, you can.
You can absolutely say, there's always a charge nurse who's in charge of making patient assignments. You can ask to speak to the charge nurse, and you can get a new nurse. Don't feel bad or guilty or like you're hurting anybody's feelings. People will be fine. I promise you, they'll go home and they'll keep going on about their lives if you ask for a new nurse. So I know it can be challenging, especially sometimes for women, to speak up about things and you're worried about hurting people's feelings and things like that. But you can always ask for a new nurse.
Absolutely. This is not related to birth, but I signed up with a personal trainer at my gym, and I was assigned to this amazing person, and she was great. But I realized a couple weeks into it that maybe we weren't the best fit for one another. And I hesitated for two more weeks to like say, hey, can I switch? And now that I've switched, oh my gosh, it's the best decision I made.
Right.
And I get to see her at the gym all the time.
Right.
And I went up to her and was like, I love you. Thank you so much. Like, this is, you know, this has been great, but this is what I'm doing. And mm-hmm. it was a wonderful breakup. You don't even have to break up with someone like that, though.
Yeah.
Like, you really don't. It doesn't have to be. And I was so nervous, but this is your space. This is your birth. This is your experience. You have to protect it and keep it what you need. And if someone's not jiving, that nurse specific, like, you can say, hey, thank you so much for your services, but I would like to switch. It's okay.
Definitely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you don't want to like go back at the end of the day and be like, oh, I had this nurse and it was the worst mm-hmm. 7 hours. Like, that's not positive. We want to look at our birth with a positive view, not a negative view.
Yeah. And your nurse is going to be there way more than your doctor. Way more. So
you
definitely want to be, you know, in sync with your nurse.
Yeah. And something else too, I tell our clients all the time, our doula clients, like, hey, upon arrival, if we're not there, like, say, hey, I would really love a nurse that fits in line with blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
And a lot of times they assign it right then. And you're like, oh my gosh, you guys are amazing. Thank you.
Yep, exactly. Definitely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So next question, what should I consider if my goal would be to have a home birth? So from a hospital OBGYN, where do you fit in that? Like, what would you suggest? I know a lot of OBs are like, don't go to home.
So I would say Tolac at home makes me nervous, but that's because I've seen uterine ruptures before and how quickly things can change.
Mm-hmm.
So, but however, some, like in Canada, I think their specialty society guidelines support doing a Tolac at home after one C-section. So it's not that it's unheard of, but I will say it makes me nervous. Now, if you do want to do it at home, then absolutely have someone who is experienced. This is not the time to have like a brand new midwife, I think you want to have somebody who has some experience and particularly looking for any signs and symptoms of when to go to the hospital. Yeah. You also need a clear plan for hospital transfer. And ideally that midwife wants to have, should have a relationship with the hospital mm-hmm. so that she feels comfortable going to the hospital in a timely fashion. One of the things that I've seen unfortunately happen during my career with home births that have not turned out optimally is that people are afraid to go to the hospital. So they stay at home too often. And then by the time they get to the hospital, it's like a train wreck. Mm-hmm. And that's not good for anybody involved. So you want it to be a situation where the midwife is like, feels comfortable going to the hospital in a mm-hmm. timely fashion. For example, where I work with home birth midwives in my community. I have gone out to the birth centers and things and said, hey, if you want to transfer somebody, just let us know. Call up.
You've done that.
Yeah, it's important. So call, send the records. We have a really smooth process. Nobody bats an eye now when there's a transfer from home birth. So you really want to have those two things in place, a skilled midwife and a good backup plan, preferably with a relationship to the hospital.
I love that. Such great advice. Awesome that you're doing that for your community. I just had an interview the other day with a VBAC mom who's toying with the idea, not sure where to go. She asked me and I was like, well, you could do dual care. You could establish mm-hmm. a relationship with a provider. You can ask your provider out of hospital of choice if they do have that relationship, mm-hmm. because you do think it is important, because sometimes even the midwife's like, I don't know where to go. You know, so I love that you've done that and like gone into the birth centers there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we just talked about fetal monitoring, but one of the questions was, is intermittent monitoring safe with VBAC? Just in general.
Yeah, it hasn't really been studied very much. And I would say our general, and it's not going to be, that's the thing. So yeah. I don't think, it's just not something that anybody's going to sign up for and say, hey, you get monitoring, let's you do don't it. Get monitoring and see what happens in a situation of a VBAC. So I can't answer that question based on data. I will just say that in general, we want to do continuous monitoring.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay, so small lumps under my C-section scar, what mm-hmm. could that be? Would/could it impact the outcome of my VBAC?
It's probably scar tissue.
That's what I thought when mm-hmm. I saw that question come in. Yeah. And I think that dials into like going and chatting with someone with like Ask Jeanette or a pelvic mm-hmm. floor PT or someone who can help massage that scar tissue. Because anytime we have a cut, whether it be from a C-section or you fell and scraped your knee and cut your mm-hmm. knee open on a rock or a twig, our body will develop scar tissue. And sometimes it clumps. Yeah. Sometimes it gets that.
Yeah, it's probably just scar tissue. And no, it should not impact your ability to have a VBAC.
Have you ever seen this within your TOLAC world, your VBAC world, where sometimes we've got thicker scar tissue and sometimes mm-hmm. There's separation within the scar tissue internally as baby's coming down and making their way through or uterus is contracting. And so sometimes it can be like, oh my gosh, I've got this like burning sensation in my scar, which we hear and it's like, that's concerning, right? Because we know that sometimes uterine rupture can be that feeling of burning mm-hmm. sensation or pain. Mm-hmm. And usually that pain doesn't go away and just keeps improving.
Right.
But have you ever seen that with someone and where they're like, oh, I've got this burning sensation and could it be scar tissue stretching?
Maybe so. Now that you think about it, not that I can think of off the top of my head, definitely. Sometimes you have to be careful when you hear people say they're having pain in their mm-hmm. abdomen. Could it be scar tissue stretching? Possibly. So that's definitely a possibility.
Yeah. It's something that's crossed my mind mm-hmm. Over all the years, especially as babies coming down and mm-hmm. kind of putting that extra pressure there.
Right.
Okay. So again, this is kind of something that we talked about earlier. So to what extent are D cells considered normal in early and late labor?
So D cells aren't, we don't categorize these cells based on the stage of labor necessarily. It's based on how they look. And again, like over the course of how mm-hmm. the tracing looks. Now, sometimes right at the end, we're going to tolerate and during pushing some D cells because you're pushing and squeezing. So there's going to be D cells. So mm-hmm. we may tolerate them more towards the end. But other than that, it really just depends.
Okay. That makes sense. I feel like sometimes as a doula, we're getting into that transition, almost mm-hmm. pushing stage. Mm-hmm. And they come in and they're like, hey, so we're wondering if maybe you're ready to push here right. soon, you know, or something's going on based off of some D mm-hmm. cells. Mm-hmm. Not that they were concerning, but they're seeing them.
Yeah.
But really, D cells in general, overall, you're going to look at the whole versus mm-hmm. one contraction or two Correct. Contractions.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. PROM. So premature rupture of membranes mm-hmm. and pre-E with VBAC. Mm-hmm. It says, is it still safe? We'll answer sure. from my own experience. Yes.
Absolutely.
Time too with PROM. Mm-hmm. So if we're not mm-hmm. having labor begin or we're maybe kind of contracting, like what's handled in that situation, especially knowing that in some hospitals around the world and in the US don't allow Pitocin.
Right.
Even yeah. though that's also not necessarily a contraindication.
Correct. So with PROM, so water breaking before labor starts, it's not as common, but it does happen. You can do expectant management, and roughly within 24 hours, most people will start to go into labor on their own. So mm-hmm. you can do expectant management, but Pitocin is actually quite safe in those circumstances. The risk of uterine rupture is low. So Pitocin mm-hmm. can definitely be used. You just want to use it carefully.
Yeah. And at what point what you kind of mentioned that 24 hours, like most people mm-hmm. within 24 hours will start contracting and, mm-hmm. and having labor, whether it be active at that point or not. But mm-hmm. at what point could it be concerning? And maybe if we have like GBS or something like that, a factor, would we be like, yeah. hey, we could keep waiting for the 24 hour mark, and that's not to like go in and have a C-section. That's just mm-hmm. maybe to augment. Mm-hmm. Like, when would you encourage augmentation sooner?
So I'm a little bit of an outlier. I just offer the options, and we can talk about that. It'll take longer. It may take longer if you wait to augment, and mm-hmm. that's it. It may take longer.
And that's it. Yeah.
And that can potentially increase the risk of infection. But it's not, we don't really do time limits. I don't do like it's 18 hours you have to, or 24 hours you have to. I kind of pick like, these are moments for us to have discussions about where things are. So definitely, usually 6, 12, 18, 24, and just let's touch base, see where things are and kind of develop an ongoing plan, not necessarily like have a hard and fast rule that you have to be delivered or by a certain point.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then preeclampsia. So we have seen this quite a bit in our community on Facebook and on Instagram where they said, hey, like there was a post just the other day and I said, hey ladies, I just wanted to thank you so much for, you know, being here in this group. You guys have been amazing. Unfortunately, I have to sign off of this group because my provider said I have to have a C-section now because I've developed preeclampsia. Mm-hmm. So didn't even offer the option to Tolac mm-hmm. or monitor. And everyone's like, wait, what? Like, this is a thing. And so it really kind of like created this like, wait, is this a thing? We can't Tolac. So obviously we know that we can.
Yeah.
And everyone's numbers vary. Like if we've mm-hmm. got severe preeclampsia, maybe mm-hmm. that's not going to be best for the stress of mom mm-hmm. and baby and everybody. But yeah, do you have anything to say on that? I don't really know how, if I'm asking the question, but.
Yeah, no, you can definitely try for, you know, you can definitely Tolac in the setting of preeclampsia. Now, and even in severe preeclampsia, it just may take longer. But if we're seeing that you're getting sicker and labor isn't progressing or the baby is under distress, mm-hmm. then the safer thing may be a C-section. So if you have severe preeclampsia, for example, and it's affecting your liver and your levels of your liver enzymes are going up, 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 and we're not close to delivery, then it's going to be safer for your health to expedite birth. Which, mm-hmm. and that's going to be a C-section. So it really depends. But the option of like completely taking it off the table, that is not standard or that's not evidence-based.
Yeah. And for HELLP syndrome, where it's mm-hmm. kind of like gone to that like extreme. Now mm-hmm. we've got platelet issues and things mm-hmm. like that. Can someone with HELLP syndrome Tolac, or is that truly a better option to have a C-section?
I would actually prefer, if someone ideally is in labor with HELLP syndrome, actually, a vaginal birth is going to be safer because when your platelets are low and then we're adding surgery, the increase bleeding. Of bleeding goes
up. Yes. So, that is what is so weird to me. Like my fifth birth was a HELLP syndrome. She was a VBAC and they're like, you have to have a scheduled C-section. But then we did all these like transfusions and all these mm-hmm. things. And I was like, in my head, I was like, But isn't platelet meaning we have a higher risk of bleeding?
Yeah.
But so yeah, that's another question. So help
yeah.
syndrome. Okay. Okay. Let's see. I think there's only one or two, maybe. Oh, is it? This is a really great question. Is it safe to TOLAC? So again, listeners, TOLAC, if that's new for you, trial of labor after cesarean. I know I've thrown it out a couple times this podcast. After having a hemorrhage in a C-section. So had a C-section, hemorrhaged. Now they're wanting to TOLAC. Is that considered safe?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, I want to discourage people from using the word safe. What I think, because I think what you really want to know is what are the risks of something happening again? So, yeah so it's not just because what do you mean by safe? You know, so yeah, what you really want to know is what are the risks of this, you know, thing happening again? So there are no identified increased risk having a TOLAC after you had a postpartum hemorrhage during a previous C-section. So,
okay. Yeah. Love that. So that's good. Because, I mean, hemorrhage, anytime anyone hemorrhages with birth, I feel like it's a little bit on everyone's radar, right? Okay. And then I have one more question for you before I let you go. And I don't know if it's Bandel's ring or Bandit's ring. How do you say that?
Yeah, Bandel's ring.
Bandel's ring. So... with one, what is a Bandel's ring for those who it's very new to?
Yeah.
And then TOLACing, having a VBAC with Bandel's ring. Is
it's a really tight ring of muscle in the uterus where it's just really tight and it doesn't contract. I can only recall seeing it like once in 22 years. So it's not
more
common.
Rare.
Yeah, it's very rare. So it's just really hard to have a vaginal birth if there's a really tight ring of tissue that is preventing the uterus from opening. So if the uterus can't open, then the baby can't come out. So that's the issue. And it's not like we can release it or clear it up or anything. And we don't know why it develops, but it's just like anything, if it's tightly closed,
it's really difficult to open.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that makes so much sense. And is there a way to find out if we have that beforehand?
Not really.
Yeah. Okay. And the signs of really that Bandel's ring is just like lack of progression.
Yeah.
Overall, it seems like.
Lack of progression. And also the baby usually doesn't come down in the pelvis.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That was a one-off random. It just like crossed my mind. I keep seeing that one too.
Right.
And okay, anything else that you'd like to touch on? I love all your points of like, let's stop considering the word safe and talk about like, what are the risks here and what do we need to know to make the best educated decision?
Yep.
Having a collaborative discussion and relationship with our provider. So many great points along the way. Anything else that you'd like to add or say to the community of someone who really is wanting to know all the information they can to VBAC and unsure which way to go?
I think that the best thing is just to really find a supportive provider, doctor, midwife, and do that in the prenatal appointments. Ask those questions early and don't be afraid to change to someone else if you feel. And sometimes you may not have options, but if you have options, then find someone who is the most appropriate for you, because that is going to be the thing that most sets you up for success. Oh, also get a doula.
Hey, love it. I will never not advocate for doulas. But really, I mean, I love it. You're pointing out again, like before birth, you guys. So early on, ask those questions. Always have a conversation with your provider. If something is switching, it's okay to switch. And I know it's daunting. It is daunting. It really is.
Yes.
I didn't want to cheat on I felt I was cheating.
Right.
On this doctor. Like we had this relationship. He was, I don't even know what I thought. I thought I was cheating on him by leaving him and I didn't leave him.
Right.
And I didn't find myself having the experience that I wanted or feel like I deserved.
Right.
And looking back, like probably should have switched. Well, I didn't have learned, but I don't want anyone else to be in that situation of like, dang it, I saw all the red flags.
Yes.
And it didn't switch because I felt bad.
Yeah. I don't mean to sound like flippant or, but I can guarantee you, your doctor, if you leave, they're just going to keep seeing patients. They're just going to go home and keep living their lives. It's going to be fine.
I know.
Yes.
I had a friend and she was like, looking back, do you realize how it wouldn't have impacted his life at all? And I was like, yes. But in my mind,
I know in the moment, I had it because that emotional connection, and we're like, you care about those things. So that's totally natural.
Yeah. And in a lot of ways, he was saying, yeah, sure, I'll support you. But then in a lot of other ways, he wasn't saying with his words, but he was saying, no, it's not my thing.
Right.
So yeah, you deserve the best. And keep doing your research, find a provider, get a doula, hands down. Just a reminder, everybody, we have VBAC certified doulas on our website all over the world. And yeah, thank you so much. You're the best. And everyone, go follow her podcast and wait out for these new updates.
Yeah, so these new updates are so, so exciting.
Yes. I'm so excited for you. That's so awesome. Yeah. You are just incredible. We really enjoy you. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Interested in sharing your VBAC? Head over to thevbaclink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbaclink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.
Hey everybody, I just wanted to take a quick sec to thank you all so much for listening to today's episode. We are so glad that you are here. This community is near and dear to our heart. We love you all so much. If you enjoyed today's episode, we would really appreciate it if you'd leave us a rating and review. Our whole team here at the VBAC Link actually gets to see these reviews come in, and it makes our day. A 5-star rating helps us share our podcast and gets these important messages out there. Thank you so much for listening, and we cannot wait to see you next time.